sense.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
All right, welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul, and Dennis is gone, but we have the great Anton. Anton James, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good.
Thank you so much for doing this free podcast.
Yeah, of course.
I say that to everybody, but right. I genuinely am thankful because you're not getting paid.
That's good to know.
Just a heads up to that. So how have you been there?
I've been good. I've been doing really good.
What have you been up to?
I've been pretty busy. I've been doing travel back and forth to Massachusetts and Florida. I'm originally from Salem, Massachusetts, and lived in Gloucester, Massachusetts most of my life. And so I go back and forth to either see family or do a show, or I have a couple lectures coming up that I'm going to go to do in the area.
Okay.
So, yeah, so that's been basically it. And working here at the estate and just, yeah.
How long did you know we're at the Magic Estate now? We interviewed Phil here as well. And so how did this all come about? You all, a bunch of magicians, live in one house in the middle of Florida, and it's not a gay thing. It's a magical thing, which some could see as the same thing.
Right. Could be a little confusing.
Both great. Both good things.
Yeah, so it came about in an interesting way. Jeff Kaler and myself, we became friends in Massachusetts. We had a mutual magician buddy, and he lived in Beverly, which is about 30 minutes away from Gloucester. So he and I would hang out quite a bit. And then Jeff was in the development of a trick, which is actually like the long-lost effect of the estate, because we haven't released it. It hasn't been out there, but it was in the very, very beginning. He was working on this, and he had submitted it. It was a variation of a Michael Amar effect. So he had communicated with Michael about it, and they seemed to hit it off, and Michael just said, hey, why don't you come down, and we'll take a look at this and just, you know, see what it's all about. And so Jeff started traveling down to visit with Michael and started working on some different things. And then with I have a background in design.
Okay.
And I've worked in different media production. And so the project turned to need some of the services I could provide for him, so I started coming down to assist with that stuff. So we had a really good time, and we started ending up spending more time here in Orlando than we were up north. So around the time that I graduated from college, we had decided that we were just going to throw all our stuff in the back of a car, and we were going to drive down. It was actually, Jeff was in one car with all of his stuff, and then I was in my car with our other friend, Jesse Feinberg, who is, you'd know him from working with Chris Angel. He was on all the last Spike series they did. And so the three of us, we put all our stuff in the car, and we drove down here. We had a timeshare for a week. We had no idea where we were going to end up afterwards. And so we just started hunting around, and eventually we found this house, and we thought it was perfect. And so the landlords, the people who had the house, they worked out a great deal with us, so we were able to come in and start doing what we do here, like right away, right after the timeshare.
Wow.
And so we've been here ever since. So
you guys do like open mics and stuff here as well?
Yeah, last night they did an open mic night. So we had musicians and we some different local creative talent. So everybody just kind of comes over and hangs out, has a good time. And so we do that, and we do magician jams. Back in the very beginning, we were doing them on a very regular basis. We haven't done one for a while at this point, but, you know, we would get all the local magicians from the area to come over, and we'd have a good time. Somebody would put on a performance or something like that. I actually did, like, my very first Naked Mentalist set here at the estate, so that was...
Could you explain that? I know you did that at Universal, and you've done that in a couple different locations. Where's the inspiration to be a nude mentalist?
Right, so... Well, yeah, I've done all different kinds of performing, and so the Naked Mentalist was just something that kind of started off as a joke amongst friends, like, wouldn't it be funny if you came out on stage and you had nothing but cue cards, and maybe your mouth was taped shut so you couldn't talk, and it could be a combination of humor that's on the cue cards and a voiceover or other visual aids, and basically it would be a naked guy playing mind games with you, in kind of a cheeky, innuendo-y sort of way. And that's kind of what the joke started off as. And I shared the joke with different friends, and they would elaborate on the joke. Somebody would add, oh, you should, you know, do the gray elephant in Denmark. And, you know, the trunk could be something obvious. And then, you know, so everybody started throwing their own sort of spin on that. And then about 2 years after kind of joking about it and having it as a thought in the back of my head, friend of mine, Tyler Sutter from 20 Penny Circus, he was here at one of those jam nights, one of those magician jam sessions, and came up to me and said, you know, we're doing a show, and we would really love it if the poster could read 20 Penny Circus featuring the Naked Mentalist. Do you think you can, you know, do you want to do it? Do you have any interest? We would want like 15 minutes, and the show is about 30 days away. And so I had not really up to that point had any motivation or reason to take it seriously and really, you know, go out there and do it. I was happy performing as myself and, you know, doing comedy magic and what have you. So when the challenge was thrown down, I said, yes, I want to do it. And so within 30 days, I had gotten together like the first 15-minute set. Wow. And I had done a version of that set, which was, you know, 5 minutes shy, maybe about 10-minute set here at the house one of those nights. But that was all for like friends and people I knew. And so that was one thing. And then when it came time to do the actual show, which there ended up being, I think, around 500 people in the audience, four or five, I'm standing in the wing and I've got my privacy board, which is really the only thing between me and the audience. And I'm getting ready to go out there and do this material, and I'm looking around and I'm just thinking, what did I get myself into? Oh my goodness, this is crazy. I really couldn't believe it because I was one of those kids growing up where I was like very shy.
Yeah.
Like when I told my mom I wanted to do this, like just I was running it by her just to make sure that she would think it was okay. She was like, oh, Anton, like, I know you would never do anything that would embarrass me, but I'm just like so surprised you'd even want to do that, because she just knew how shy I was about, you know, my body and all that. So I go to do this first show, and I'm walking out onto the stage, and I'm literally like a couple feet away from the first row of the audience. And this guy, I just all of a sudden hear somebody go, oh my goodness. And I turn over, and it's this big, big, buff, bald guy. And he just looks at me from toe to tip, from toe to head. And he's just got this look on his face, like he can't believe that he's like staring at this naked guy right in front of him. So I'm like, okay, this is going to be interesting for sure. I had no idea what to expect. So I get up there, I go through my opening lines, I get a great reaction. I just start running at that point. That particular set is pretty well timed out to each beat. Like it has to just kind of run to work. It's a timing and pacing thing. And so I get to this one spot about 10 minutes in where there's a pause for a joke. And I just all of a sudden hear somebody like dying out in the audience. And I look over and it's that big, buff, bald dude. And he's like red in the face. He's laughing so hard at this joke. And I felt so good at that moment. It was like such a great moment. So, and after the show, he came up to me and he's like, oh my gosh, man, you're crazy. I'm going to tell my friends about you. So based on that guy's reaction, this dude who could have been my like biggest critic, like the biggest hater in the audience, that's what I was, you know, thinking this guy was going to be for me right off the bat. He ended up really loving it. So that's when I was like, wow, there actually might be something here. Like this might be worth doing again. And so basically I just, when people would ask if it seemed like the right opportunity to get up on that stage and do it, I would do it. So,
wow.
Yeah. So, but that's kind of how that all got started. So
I was going to say, do you do that for corporate events? Do they require?
If it was like Naked Juice or if it was, you know, some company that had a tie-in and wanted it, I would absolutely do it. And so my rule of thumb is, you know, and right now my creative energy is going into just focusing on putting myself out there on stage as much as possible. But when it comes to the Naked Mentalist, I say he's like Superman. He shows up exactly when he's needed. So it has to really be the right event, and it almost has to be the kind of thing where I'm like, oh yeah, these guys need this. Like this event begs to have the Naked Mentalist show up and, you know, do his thing. So yeah, so I'm selective about where I choose to do it. So yeah. But if Naked Juice or somebody, you know, some corporate thing, it would work for them.
It's sad, but I heard Naked Jews at first.
Oh,
that's a whole nother market.
That could be. Yeah, yeah. Actually,
West Palm Beach.
Actually, it's funny you should say that because I've been asked to do a couple different nudist resorts.
Really?
Doing it. And I actually did do one and just recently. And I guess it's supposed to be the largest one on the East Coast or something like that. And they were awesome. Great audience. Like, they were super fun. Any even little cheeky, like, a line that might be a throwaway line for a different audience.
Yeah.
Like, they were just, like, exploding over.
That's got to be, I would think, an easy audience because those people already don't give an F Like, I'm naked.
Yeah, right, right. There was no, it was just like a very free and open set and, you know, no concern wow. about, you know, upsetting anyone or anything like that or, you know, with cheeky humor or anything like that. Because I'm very selective about that because I really don't want anyone ever to have a bad taste in their mouth about that sure. sort of thing. I like to just find the line and walk up to it. I'm not trying to cross it and, like, really offend anybody or anything like that. So, and like I was saying before, like, nothing I've ever done on stage as the Naked Mentalist is something that my, if my mom was in the audience, she'd be like, oh, Anton, why'd you do that? Like, she, you know, would find it funny as well. So that's kind of my barometer by which I judge things is if my mom was in the audience, how would she feel about seeing her son say this sort of thing?
I had to do a, student showcase at Second City in Chicago. One of the last scenes I had to do was me pretending I was in television being a part of this porn video, and it was just me doing all these absurd physical movements, and my mom was in the front row, and it was maybe the most uncomfortable 5 minutes of my life. So if you can avoid doing the nudity and the nakedness in front of your parents, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, yeah, it's a you don't want to cross that particular line. So
she just kind of shook my hand at the end of the show. All right, all right.
That's funny.
So this is kind of a stereotypical question, but why magic? How'd you get started?
Sure. So I love magic, and ever since I was a kid, I was just very inquisitive and always kind of trying to see what was what. And my dad, I remember many nights, like, we would sit out in the backyard, and he would look up at the sky and say, and to think that goes on forever and ever and ever. And so he really put a lot of these big mystery kind of thoughts in my head as a young kid. And my dad's also, he's a self-motivated person. He's a businessman, and his father started a business. And when he gave it to him, it was just like a couple trucks. And my dad has grown it to being a much bigger thing. And his father didn't even believe that was going to ever happen. He thought it was totally impossible. So ever since growing up, my dad has, you know, really put that message of anything is possible, and that if you dream it, you can do it. And I did it, so you can do it. And he's always kind of put that and these other, like, bigger picture things in my head as a kid. And I just think magic is such a great tool for kind of exploring that stuff. It's like one of the few, you can create wonder and joy instantly for people and make people happy. And there was just something about that that I was really attracted to. My father also bought me a lot of magic tricks for birthdays and, you know, Christmas. The, you know, same story a lot of people do. And so the only thing that was interesting, though, about it was growing up, and I never thought much about it, was he would perform the trick for me, and then I would see it performed, and then he would, after fooling me with the trick, he would then explain to me how it worked in private, away from the rest of the family. So now I would know how to do the trick, and I could repeat it. And so it wasn't until I was 18, he said, you know, there's something I want to show you. And so he brings me downstairs into the basement. And again, we own a moving company, so we have, like, boxes everywhere in this basement. And he goes and he opens up a cabinet and he pulls out a big trunk and he pops the trunk open. And it's a whole collection of Royal and Adams magic and a Charlie McCarthy doll.
Oh, wow.
And it's all in this trunk. And it turned out that my dad, right up until around he was in his 20s, had an interest in entertaining and performing. And he kind of stepped away from that so he could, you know, do the more practical thing and focus on the family business. So he shows this to me, and, like, it literally blew my mind. It was just like a crazy twist revelation, but it made sense why he was able to perform it, why he was able to then, you know, show and explain the secret to me later, because he had spent some time already in his life learning magic. I remember he had, like, the Lotta bowl, and he had, you know, a metal thumb tip, and, you know, he had these, you know, great classic props. So yeah, a lot of my interest in magic, you know, came from him as kind of a gift. Like, he passed it along to me with his attitude and his actions, and physically by buying the, you know, the tricks and providing them to me as a kid. So I think, and he did the same thing for my two older brothers, but they didn't stick to it. They got interested in cars and stuff like mm-hmm. that at a different point. They kind of went in a different direction. But for me, when I was 13, I had done my first show, and I actually had done it as a juggler. I hadn't, like, the thought to become a magician hadn't really occurred to me yet. I had just been learning these tricks, like, from holidays, from time to time. I didn't have, like, a routine. I would just go and do, like, one trick for somebody. But I knew how to juggle, and I had seen jugglers at Faneuil Hall growing up. So I had known how to put together a juggling routine. So like the first show I did, I was like 13. It was a couple hours worth of juggling. And I think I got paid like $100. And when I got that check, I was like, I'm never working again. So that was definitely like why I got into, that was part of how I got into entertaining, was that experience and seeing young that I could do it, that I could make a living at it, that opportunity was there. And so I just had never let go of that.
It does mess with you a little bit, because like I started going professional around 14, 15 too, not anything big, but small parties and things like that. And it jades you a little bit, because you're like, okay, I can make this amount of money for working for an hour or two, or I can work a whole week and make the same amount. And, if you're good and if you're consistent, you can, that's a good way to make a living. But it's it does, I think, mess with you a little bit and stops you from pursuing a real job.
Yeah. And I think just when I saw that potential, that it was possible for me to do that, to do something that I really loved and I was really passionate about, and to actually, be paid for it, was like a pretty powerful thing. And also, again, having my dad there telling me the whole time, like, if this is the thing you want to do, you can do it. You just have to figure it out.
Yeah, that helps.
And yeah, and so I think that's actually one of the most important things anybody can hear, is that, like, if you dream it, you can do it. Because I think a lot of people, if you don't have somebody there in your life, like, I was very lucky to have my dad, who had already accomplished something that his father didn't even think was possible. So he knows what it takes and what, you have to put into it to make something happen. So he was able to pass that along to me. And, if I really wanted to be a magician, that I just had to put the work in, that it was possible. Whereas I think other people's parents might have to look at them, just to say, for instance, and not that there's anything wrong with it, but if maybe you have lived your whole life working a job for somebody else, and that is all you've ever known, and that regular paycheck is all you've ever known, it might be hard to look your son in the face and say, oh, sure, you can be a magician and go do this crazy thing. What my dad accomplished with the business, and again, it's a moving and storage and logistics company, which sounds boring, but it's really like a wild adventure, like every single day. And so he knew firsthand, like, you're going to have days that are awesome and days that are hard. And, even if you're doing the exact thing you love, there's still going to be really difficult days, because he dreamed of having that fleet of trucks since he was 6 years old. So, and was able to accomplish it. So he knows what it takes to go into that. So yeah, I think for me at that age, having done that show and kind of, having my, that support from my dad, that's really why I never let it go. And mm-hmm. I just said, this is what I want to do and I love it, so that's what I'm going
to
do.
I think that's important, to have a strong moral influence being a magician, because a lot of people will often, they probably ask you too, how do you get into magic? I'm like, well, watch a lot and then have a good teacher, or have somebody that's going to push you. And that's really, I think, 90% of it, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, exactly. And so he was always very aware of trying to help and support me and put me in front of different groups of people, from an early age, and just really encouraging it, in every way that he knew how to. So, and, I was lucky that I was able to, that I've been able to put myself into it and actually get a good result mm-hmm. out of it. So, but yeah, and that's why I say I think it's one of the most important things anybody can ever hear, is that if you, if you see it, you can be it. If you dream it, you can do it. You just have to know that. And it can be difficult if you haven't been told that or shown that in your life, like, firsthand. So, there's a couple of people I think of that I know of that I think they defeat themselves without even trying, because they've made up their minds that they couldn't do the thing they want to do already.
Yeah. Well, it's really easy to get into that state of mind if you go on YouTube and you see the kajillion other magicians out there, other good performers. It's so easy to get inside your head and go, oh, I'll never be as good as that guy. When really you can, you just kind of have to turn that off, and that's really hard to do, I think.
Right, right. Yeah, and as a kid, for me, again, like, when you talk about seeing people on YouTube, I was fortunate to get to see the jugglers and the magicians at Faneuil Hall in Boston, which is known as the number one street performing pitch in the world. Mm. And so, as a kid, I just would see these people on the street doing these things and just getting, it was inspiring, but it was a sense of wonder watching these guys do what they do. And same thing when YouTube started coming around, I was on that every day, like looking at every juggler, every magician, like from all over the world, and just seeing these people do this incredible stuff, and saying to myself, wow, I want to give people the same feeling that I'm having right now as I watch this, that sense of inspiration to reach and try to do something more than what I'm currently doing. That was like a mind-blowing thing, to be able to see performers from all over the world without leaving your living room. Like, yeah. It's, you know, silly to say now, but it's really like, if you wanted to see somebody, you either had to buy it on VHS or you had to be there when the guy did it. And now you can see so many amazing performers from all over just, with a click of a button on the computer. So.
It's why I think Pendulette's talked about just like juggling and magic has gotten immensely better since YouTube, just because people are seeing more of it and coming up with their own ideas and their own original spins on it. So that is the positive aspect of it, I think, for sure.
Yeah, right. And again, yeah, like as you were saying, you could easily see it and go, oh no, I'll never be that good. And it's like, but you try, and you know, it's that saying, if you aim for the moon, if you miss, you land amongst the stars sort of thing. And I just am a big, actually, I'm bummed Dennis wasn't here. I was going to say, I'm a big learn by doing sort of person.
Yeah.
And Dennis was here for at one of my last learning experiences, which was for the Empire Vampire video shoot.
Oh, okay,
And so you remember, or you're aware he did that,
yeah.
Where and I believe he was playing Balthazar, and he had a great role. He was sitting next to the lead singer of the group, and levitating a card and like looking really cool, and so that was a neat thing. So the close-up experience, which was the group that put that together, had gotten in touch with me and said, hey, do you like want to throw something in here? Like, would you want to give, what do you got sort of thing? And I was like, well, you've got a juggler, you've got a magician, you've got, these different things. I can do some fancy stuff with a pack of cards. Let me show you. And so I just did a couple of, simple flourishy things. And I said, do you have any interest in putting this stuff on camera? And I suggested it for the reason that, one, it wasn't something that they already had. It wasn't on the list of talents that they had already mentioned. And two, I had always wanted to try my hand at doing that, like just doing something cool and fancy with a deck of cards and a video.
And this is this is a music video that shot here in Florida.
Right. Yeah. So this was, it was a music video shot here in Florida. And I think the final piece ended up being about 4 minutes or something. 4 or 5 minutes. And so it was really an interesting learning experience. Again, that was another F-word thing. We did it for free. Yeah. But it was for fun. And again, it was a learning thing and this chance to kind of fulfill a dream of mine of doing something cool on video. And so it was really a great thing, the amount of talent that was pulled together to make the video and the final product, which was just released this past week. Incredible amounts of talent, the makeup artists, everything about it. My experience was this. So I show up to the thing. As things often are in the world of production, they're like a bit off schedule. Schedule's maybe been rearranged. Communication is, what it is. But they're working. Everybody is working it. The makeup, people are doing it as quick as they can and making everybody look amazing. And the camera guys are doing everything to set up the shots as best as possible and work with this really interesting, antique venue, we'll call it that. Mm-hmm. It was just like a very nice, stately place. And so we get there, and we were scheduled for one time, and because of the nature of the way they were shooting, and they didn't get to us till my spot till like way later. So I probably, by the time I was like all said and done, had maybe spent commitment like 6+ hours being around, like waiting for this opportunity to do my thing on film and see what we get. And what I didn't know going into it was essentially the way that was going to work was they set the shot up and they just put the talent on the spot and said, do your thing. And so I was like, okay, cool. I'm typically, in other shoots that I've worked with and stuff, whether it's behind the camera or as talent, it's more like every shot is like set up and like, here, we're going to want you to do this and do it just like this as this thing's happening. And that was more my expectation. But for the segment I was working, it was more of like a freestyle throwdown. And so that was cool. So as soon as I realized that's what it was going to be, I put together a little set in my mind. Okay, I'll do the fans and I'll do the arm spreading catch and I'll do these things. And See how it goes. And so I get up there. It's my moment. You know, I got to look cool. It's attitude thing. Everybody's supposed to be a vampire. So I'm, you know. Oh, I guess the one thing I would add is I've never had contacts in my eyes before, ever.
No.
And that's not... I have a thing with putting stuff near my eyes. And...
I won't tell you I got LASIK and laser shot into my eyes. I won't tell you that.
Oh, no, please don't. Yeah, I couldn't handle it. I was a sword swallower for 2 years, right?
Oh, wow.
2-3 years. And I could do that, no problem. But yeah. I can't put contacts. I just stuff near my eyes. So in addition to the makeup and getting an on-the-spot haircut before going out to, you know, do this by one of the makeup people there, they just gave me a quick trim, which I wasn't expecting either, but it looked good. So I had to put contacts in, and I was useless trying to put these things in. Somebody had to, I had to put my head against a wall and hold my eyes open and have somebody physically put them in. So the whole thing happens. I get up there, I throw down my stuff. I think I did 2 takes. It was very quick. It was like for the 6 hours I'd been there, I probably was in front of that camera for a few, 2-3 minutes maximum, like very brief, which was totally cool. And then, so we leave. It took a while for the video to get edited. As I said, it just came out last week. And I think I'm probably in it for a total of 3 seconds. Totally. So that was my experience, but it was awesome. And I really loved, and it was the kind of thing, it's like, I'm thrilled that I didn't fully make it onto the cutting room floor, that there is a shot of me handling the cards, a shot of my face, which is really nice. But it's just funny because sometimes you go in to do something like that and you end up, it could be a whole day thing just to get 3 seconds of footage. But that was like my last learning thing that I did, that I just kind of went out to do for the fun of it. And it's actually nice because it's come up again where somebody's now asked me to do it, and I'll be a lot more prepared to do it this second time around. So
it's funny how it's just always hurry up and wait. And I just did a beer commercial a couple of months ago, and it was like 12 hours on set, all these different camera shots, all these different things. Can't even see me, you know. It's a 20-second commercial. And it's fine. It's really, those things are the experience, and just kind of getting to understand how.
Yeah,
it all
and
works.
Being around on the set and
yeah.
stuff like that. So I always like to say yes to things. It's like the stuff that I know that I'm good at. I like, obviously that's the stuff you want to get paid for doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always fun when an opportunity comes along and it fulfills either a personal thing or a creative whim, and you have the opportunity to kind of go in there and do it and just see how it goes. And that's where a lot of the fun comes for me, because I love doing new experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Like anything I haven't tried before, I'm always up for. So, and that's, you know, I have a hard time keeping my show the same because I'm always wanting to rotate in and out.
Yeah,
new things.
You can get bored easily.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, and that's another reason why The Naked Mentalist was great, was because it allowed me to explore like a whole path that I had never gone down. It was a lot more like prop comedy and like, you know, just kind of more in your face humor than what I might have done otherwise. So, yeah, so and sometimes you do those things for free, and you know, kind of like how I was just showing up to do that first Naked Mentalist show because a friend had asked me. He was paying me, but I mean, it really was more because he asked me than anything. And then I was, you know, flash forward like a year, I was doing it at Universal Studios.
Yeah.
And that was just crazy. So it's like you just have to say yes to things and go out there and try things, because you just don't know, you know, what will lead to the next thing. And yeah, again, if you aim for the moon and you miss, you're going to land amongst the stars. Like, you know, you learn a lot. Like, so again, I did that whole experience where I only had like 3 seconds in the final thing. But still, I'm pumped that I'm in it for that 3 seconds. And I learned so much myself that now this opportunity is going to come up again, and it's going to just go that much better the next time
around.
Sure.
Yeah. Because you already know what's going on.
Yeah. So that's why I just always like to, I say yes to as much as possible with, you know, anything fun and kind of creative.
So what would be like your ultimate goal? What's something big, or it doesn't even have to be big, something that you are inspired to do, something you want to achieve in your career?
So yeah, I don't know.
Everybody here at Magic Estate has done a lot of great things.
It's really nice, and I'm sure you have a same feeling of like, I already am doing this thing that so many people kind of in my life were like, that's what you want to do? Really? You can make a living at that?
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm doing it. And so for me, it's like, that's one huge mountain, like right there, to have done that. But you know, it's funny. I love titling. Like, I've done a lot of branding and design for people and helped people name things. And I enjoy writing and stuff like that. And I do a lot of the writing for stuff that happens around here at the house. And, you know, I write my own material and what have you. So, yeah, I have, like, a bit of a wording thing. And so as a kid, you know, I was so inspired by seeing all these people and doing what they do. I think for myself, my biggest goal is to just inspire people in any way I can, whether that is through inspiring them to follow their own dream or helping them find the inspiration in what they already do. I, with the branding stuff, I have people who come to me and they say, you know, I'm trying to, let me think of it. You know, it might be something like an organization that's trying to raise money for a school or something like that. And I really love helping a group like that work out maybe what is really their inspiration and behind. Obviously, this is a good thing and they want to do it for the kids, but how can I help them dial in that message and get them excited about what it is that they're doing? So anyway, that's, I'd say, my main thing is I just want to inspire as many people as possible to know that they can and should be doing the thing that they dream or want to be doing. So it's interesting. I have a number of tattoos that either represent a lesson I've learned or something I believe in or a moment or experience that I've had in my life. And what one of my favorite ones is on my right foot. I have the words, "Make it happen." And so that's the thought there is, like, you decide what the it is, and then it's up to you to make it happen by any means necessary. You can look at other people and try to get good advice and all that, but you just, when you decide you want something, you have to ask yourself, like, why is it that I want this? Like, what is the real thing inside me that makes me want this? And is that a good reason? And will I be happy with the result if I follow through with it? But for me, that's a phrase I think about every day with anything I'm going for. Like, I always ask myself that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's kind of up to you to define the it and then figure out how to make it happen by any means necessary.
Where does that come? You talked about your father and your upbringing, but does that come from anywhere else that need to and want to inspire people or find people to have people dig deep within themselves?
You know, for me, that's, you know, again, I learned that I could entertain people when I was like 13, 14, and I really have a great time making people laugh and giving them that sense of wonder. And for me, the inspiration thing is just the next step in that. It's, for me, I guess it feels like a logical progression just because that's kind of what I live and breathe and what I work for. But yeah, I don't know. I just think there's a great sense when you can help somebody. As somebody who is actively doing something that I love and that I've dreamed of doing, there's a great sense of reward in helping somebody else be able to do that or make the connection that they are able to do that and at least get them going and excited about the fact that they could be doing the thing that they love. Or even another, you know, key sense, a key thing to inspire people about is oftentimes we're doing something and we've been doing it for so long, we lose the spark of whatever that initial interest is. And sometimes somebody coming from the outside, like, I love anybody who is like a craftsman or works a trade or has a skill or a talent or is helping people or anything like that. So sometimes having somebody come in from the outside who's very passionate about what you're doing can help re-excite that passion for yourself. So anyway, I've been doing some small talks for different business groups, and my favorite thing to do is the one-on-one time afterwards. I'll just sit around and talk to anybody who comes up and just tell me about what it is that you do, and, you know, we'll just kind of jazz and jam on different things right there. But it's a nice feeling when somebody, you know, would come up and say something like, yeah, some of those ideas have me like really excited to go back to the restaurant and, like, you know, try this with the staff or whichever it is. So, yeah, I just see it as a good use. You know, it's kind of a blending of all the different talents I've developed over the years, whether it's with design work or branding work or kind of that personal coaching stuff that I've done with businesses and individuals. And it's a mix of what I do as an entertainer. And that. So, but the bottom line is, like, really everything I'm putting my focus into these days, my end goal is to try to inspire people. Mm-hmm. So, that's, yeah, more or less where I'm at personally. So,
yeah. I'm kind of discovering that now is that I really love those moments after the show when people come up and are genuinely interested and want to talk to you. As long as they're not saying, hey, you should be on America's Got Talent. Have you seen this guy on America's
Got Talent? Oh, I know, right?
That kills me. But when, like, I had my last show yesterday, I had a guy come up. He was a magician out of New York, and we just had a nice, genuine conversation. It wasn't forced. It was just two people talking, And that those kind of little experiences I'm starting to find and explore. But I know what you mean. I get what you're saying there.
Yeah, and so even if I'm doing, like, The Naked Mentalist, which is, like, an absolutely silly, over-the-top, ridiculous thing, I still have a segment towards the end where I talk about how loving yourself is the most important thing that you can do, and to love yourself the way you are. And that's something I truly believe in, because part of what happened when I became The Naked Mentalist was when I first had the idea for the thing. I remember I told you it was a joke, and then, like, 2 years went by before I actually did it. Well, at the very beginning, when I first had the thought, I thought it was a great idea. I was like, there's definitely something here. I've never seen anybody do it. I like to do things nobody's ever done. But I was so self-conscious about my body and the way that I would look on stage and how people would handle that and whichever, that I was really like, oh, I don't know if I want to do it. And again, 2 years go by, I get up there and do it for the first time, and I weighed, I think, around 20 pounds more than when I first had the idea. But the motivation wasn't there, because I didn't have my friend Tyler saying to me, hey, like, we're doing this show, we want you to do it. That's ultimately the reason why I did it. So it was funny, the thing that stopped me for doing it for 2 years, the thing that bothered me, that was holding me back, myself, ended up not even mattering. Because not a single person in that audience, when I was done doing that show, was concerned. Again, like, my biggest hater turned into my biggest fan by the time I walked off the stage. But I realized right then and there, the thing that was bothering me, the thing that was such a big deal to me, it didn't mean anything to a single person in that room. And that was a really powerful moment for me there. So I take a little bit of that story and I put that in the Naked Mentalist performance. And that, to me, takes it from a good performance to a great performance. Sure. Because I feel that sense of connection with the audience. And because I think it's a very relatable thing. I think a lot of people have a sense or a moment of self-doubt, or we wonder, you know, people staring at this pimple on my face, or, you know, what is that? So I think it's a relatable thing that, you know, just everybody needs to love themselves and accept themselves a little bit more. And when you feel that connection with the audience, when I'm doing that part of the routine, and I can really feel people like going, yeah, yeah, no, he's right. Like, that's interesting that he went through that. That, to me, is where the magic happens. That's, to me, what I want. Like, I want as much of that as I can get when I'm in front of a live audience, for sure. Yeah. So
I always close with, you know, best gig experience, worst gig experience, but you've thrown some really good, positive gig experiences. Do you have any terrible gig experiences that come to mind that haunt you on a date?
Yeah.
I have a few.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and I'd love to hear about yours.
I've talked to him. But I'll tell
me. Tell me after, for sure. Yeah, I would tell you two real quick. And one's funny and one's, like, scary, right? So I'll tell you the scary one first, and then I'll tell you the funny one. So the scary one is that I had been sword swallowing for a couple years, and this was towards the end. I'd been doing it close to 3 years, I guess, and I'd been written up in the paper, and I had won some local radio contests, and I had been booked to do it with a couple of the circuses from New York that, you know, book shows in Boston occasionally. And so I'd really kind of done it, and I was getting ready to not do it anymore just because of the inherent risk of it, because it is real. And I realized I could make people just as happy by finding the Three of Clubs and call it a day and survive and, you know, live to perform another day. So I was getting ready to be done doing it, and Halloween rolled around, and this one booking company calls me and was like, we have this one, and this one for you. And they all pay. They were all four-figure gigs. They were a lot of money for me at the time. So I was like, yes, like, great. So I did it kind of reluctantly because the money was there. But I knew I was close to being done with it, that this was kind of going to be my last hurrah, that the October shows would be fun. And so I go to this guy's place, and it's unbelievable. It's a renovated fire station. And where one of the fire trucks would be sitting, he had a diner's car in this place. And it was open bar. He had, I think, 300 or something of his employees in this place. It was just a madhouse. It was crazy. And so he hired myself and an aerialist and a contortionist and a walk-around magician, and he just was going all out on this circus theme. And so he gives me the remote, and this is the last of these gigs. So I'm getting ready to drop the blade and then not pick it up again. I'm ready just to be done. And so I'm standing up on the balcony. He gives me a remote, and he's like, when you're ready to do your thing, click this button. The lights will all dim. A light will focus on you, and the music will start, and do your thing.
I want that button.
Awesome, right? I know. I want that everywhere I go. Yeah. Come on. So basically, I end up, again, this place is packed to the rafters with people, and I'm up there, and it's a little chaotic. It's like a little late into the night, and so I hit the button because it's my moment to shine. I hit it. The light does its thing, and as I'm getting ready to swallow the sword, I bring it up, and I'm getting ready to push it down. As I start pushing it down, and it's like going from my neck into my chest area, I start feeling people bumping up against my backside because they wanted to see what was happening, but it was like kind of drunk shuffling bumpiness. Man. And so I managed to swallow the sword and bring it back out in one piece, but I was never more terrified for something that was happening than that moment. That was like my big nightmare moment right there in the middle of something. And thankfully nothing happened, but that was like, when I was done, I was like, that is the exact reason why I don't want to be doing that again. Yeah. And that was also my inexperience at the time. Like somebody who, I was, again, like I say yes to everything. And had I might have sized up the situation differently and been more strict about what was happening. But again, it was the first and only time that's ever happened to me. But it was just kind of a glimpse of like, ooh, this is what could happen if things got a little out of control. And so I was like, okay, it's a good time to stop that. So I haven't done it since. And then my funny one was, it was just a corporate event, and I'm up on stage, and I'm doing a card trick, and we're going to do a routine to see if the spectator can win their money back, which they lost to me earlier on in the show. Silly them. And
stupid.
Silly spectator. And so I'm doing the card trick, and it's a variation of the magician's insurance policy, and ultimately I'm going to win, you know, because I'm going to have the escape clause on the thing. And I knew that they had the card I wanted them to have. I felt so good about it, and I whip open that insurance policy so triumphantly, and I'm staring at the backside of it, and through it, I can see that it's the Seven of Hearts and not the King of Clubs or whatever, and it's totally the wrong card. I've just, like, very dramatically revealed the wrong card at this corporate event, and I felt, like, really, I wanted to hit a button and disappear. It's probably, like, my only time I've ever, like, had something, like, obviously fall flat on its face at that type of a thing. But thankfully, and granted, it like still wasn't as nice as if the trick had worked right, we were wagering for the spectator's missing bill. So I said, well, it looks like I got to give you that bill back. And then I went right in and, you know, cut the lemon open, and there we were. So as far as, hopefully it didn't read as terrible as it felt, but
you had an out.
But I still just, when I opened that thing up and I realized I was staring at the wrong one, oh, I felt so silly.
Well, that happened to me, similar idea. At least you had an out. I was doing a book test, and I was doing it with a real book. But the stupidity of me is, like, it had footnotes at the bottom of the page. So I'm like, look at the last word, but don't, you know, not the footnotes, the last actual word. And this moron looked at the last footnote. So I'm up there, there's a big distance, and what was the word? Wrong. And I had no out. There's nothing you can do at that point. And I'm like, all right, let's keep going. And it was just like, everybody's looking around, and... Those moments are awful. But
yeah, it's just just something about a complete failure on your part.
Especially if I don't know how that show was going for you, but for me, this particular show was just it was crashing from like the first 5 minutes, you know, and I had to do 45 minutes.
Oh, that's tough. Yeah, for me, it was like one of three. It was like an opener, the insurance policy, and then the bill, the lemon there at the end. And my opener went okay, but it was something small and quick. So this was supposed to be like the first impressive reveal, and it just kind of did not happen. So
it's times like that I slowly lower my sign with my name on it. Hi, my name was have a great night.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just get me out of here.
Well, thank you so much for doing this podcast. It was very nice of you. And,
yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thanks,
anything,
man.
You wanted to promote? Anything we should know about?
No, just I guess the only thing I would say is that if you're a magician and you're looking for some solid magic that works in the real world, you can find my products and everybody else's at themagicestate.com. And yeah, again, I
promoted Terry Ward's.
Oh, nice.
I just got hit a couple weeks ago, and it's literally one of my favorite DVD sets.
Mine too, yeah.
If you're a professional magician, you maybe know the logistics. the professional advice in it is, you know, stellar.
Terry is unreal. He is amazing. And we've made a point to try to pick the best possible people to work with and people who inspire us.
Yeah.
And so the lessons are much bigger than the tricks that you learn. And, you know, I think to Giovanni Olivera's routine with the pennies and the audience management stuff he explains in there, that can transform your whole act. Mm-hmm. If just understanding the psychology behind what he's doing in that routine can change how basically you do everything as far as audience involvement. So, yeah, so we try to work with people that are really that, you know, just that top shelf, unbelievable quality. And Terry is just, he is a machine. That guy, he is unreal. So have you had Terry on the show?
No, we haven't. I know him really well, but we just haven't. Hopefully we can sync it up before I get out of here. So
yeah, definitely. I'm sure he'll enjoy it.
All right. Well, thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
Cool. Yeah, anytime.
Boom. Handshake.
Thank you so much for listening to Two Magicians. Please rate us on iTunes or Stitcher if you have a second. It takes about 30 seconds, not even. Questions or comments or hate mail to twomagicians1mic@gmail.com. We're on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Two Magicians. And you can donate to the podcast a dollar or two or three if you're feeling generous. twomagicians1mic.podomatic.com.